Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Comedy Concepts with your host, Nancy Lombardo.
Good morning, everyone. Wow, we've got a great comedy find today. Special treat. It's one and only Renaissance man about the comedy world, and that's Jeff Durian. Jeff Durian is a comedy writer, performer, director, author, producer, doctor, healer. He's written material for comedy legends such as Rodney Dangerfield, Terry Lewis, Bill Hartman, Richard Belzer, George Wallace, and Joan Rivers. He also performs stand-up comedy as a host and MC at Comic Strip and other New York clubs. He's written for MTV, National Lampoon, Weekly World News, and many Friar Roast. And in 1999, he launched Comedy Matters, which is a terrific, by the way, celeb-based online entertainment column. And it's involved into Comedy Matters TV and Internet TV channel with over 150 A-list celebrity interviews. Visit his website at www.jeffreygurian.com. And I hope I'm saying that correctly. And today he's on our show because he's written a terrific book. I just read it. I highly recommend it. And it's called Make 'em Laugh, 35 Years of the Comic Strip, the greatest comedy club of all time. And he is just fantastic. He's everywhere. If there's something happening in New York City and there's comedy involved, this man is there. It's just an amazing, amazing feat. I don't know how he gets everywhere, but he is there with every major celebrity. I don't think there's a comedian this man does not know. And he's just such a nice guy, too, on top of it. So we're going to find him right here. I want to start with a little, here we go.
Guy with a Doberman pincher says to a guy with a Chihuahua, let's go to a restaurant over there and get something to eat. The guy with the Chihuahua says, we can't get in there. We got our dogs with us. The guy with the Doberman pincher says, follow my lead. They go over to the restaurant. Before he walks in, the guy with the Doberman pincher puts on a pair of dark glasses. He goes to walk in. The guy says, I'm sorry, sir, no pets allowed. He says, you don't understand. This is my seeing eye dog. The guy at the door says, a Doberman pincher? He says, yes, well, they're using them now. They're excellent. All right, come on in. So the guy with Chihuahua puts on a pair of dark glasses. He's walking up to the door. The guy says, I'm sorry, sir, no pets allowed. He says, you don't understand, this is my seeing eye dog. The guy at the door says, a Chihuahua? He says, they gave me a Chihuahua? Six guys are carrying a casket out of church in the middle of winter. All of a sudden, the lead guy slips on the ice. The casket gets away. It goes down the stairs, down the road, through an intersection in the middle of town, leaps over a curb, smashes through a drugstore door, slams into the counter, the lid pops open, and the stiff sits up. The druggist says, can I help you? The stiff says, yeah, could you please give me something to stop this coughing? Sorry, you like folk songs? Puff the Magic Dragon.
That was Jackie Martley, one of the numerous comedians featured in the book, Make 'em Laugh. And now we're going to bring on Jeffrey Gurian. Here we go. Jeffrey,
hi.
Are you there? Am I saying
yes,
your name
right?
Yes,
I am
right?
Here. I'm listening. I didn't want to interrupt all the nice things that you were saying about me. You're my new publicist.
Well,
that's amazing.
Well, it's true, Jeffrey. There's not one comedy event that, if I don't see you there, it's not an event. I go,
isn't
oh,
that
Jeffrey's
funny?
Not
like,
here. I guess they didn't make Jeffrey's list, so it's not an event.
That's so funny. Like, people say that to me, and I'm like, yeah, when you get home, I'll be in your living room. I seem to show up every place. I don't even know how that happens.
Well, you are. It's true about you, Jeffrey. Another thing about Jeffrey is that he's such a creative person on so many levels. Not only does he do stand-up, but he makes these great videos, these hilarious short films, which I have featured. They've been in numerous contests, and I feature them on my cable show as well.
Yes, and thank you very much for that, by the way.
Oh, but they're hilarious.
Thank you.
Spineless Man. I tried to find them today on YouTube. Are they still up? Or
yeah, they're up on my Comedy Matters channel, and they should also be on my website. My Comedy Matters channel is on YouTube. It's youtube.com/Gurian News Network.
Oh, yeah, that's
combination.
Great, too.
It's
that's
a combination
terrific
of,
there,
thank
Jeffrey,
you.
Because I was looking at so many famous guests that you've interviewed, and most of them at the comic strip.
Yeah, well, I did all the interviews for the book at the comic strip, except for Billy Crystal, who I flew out to L.A. for, and a few guys who I did at the Just for Laughs Festival. You know, when I started the book in 2008, The first three comedians that I did were Larry Miller was first, then George Wallace and Paul Provenza, because the three of them were up at Just for Laughs, which, you know, I'm sure your audience knows.
Oh, yeah.
It's the biggest comedy festival in the world. And this year I was up there. I was given the honor of being the official celebrity interviewer. And I did 40 interviews while I was up there. It was crazy. From
That's
morning to night.
Pretty amazing.
We were interviewing everybody from Chelsea Handler and Bob Saget, Joel McHale, Triumph the Insult Comic Dog, and his father, Robert Smigel. You know, I just got everybody that was up there, the Sklar Brothers and, you know, Moshe Kasha, people from L.A., because people come from all over, you know.
It's
so
great. Well, what I like about your interviews is that people, because you're a comic, people are so relaxed with you. They don't feel something's going to come out of left field, that you're truly interested when you're interviewing them and what they have to say on comedy and where they're going. And it just, they're very relaxed. I like that.
Well, it's nice of you to say that, because people often ask me, like, how I get what I get, you know, and I think it's because they trust me, and also because I believe in putting out positive energy. Like, I don't review things, basically. I talk about being there and about the people themselves, but if I was to go to a show and I didn't like it, I would never write that, because I respect every performer. I know how hard it is to get out on a stage and do what you think is funny. You know, comedy, as you know, being
yeah.
a performer for so long, it's the hardest thing in the world. And I told that to Joel McHale, and he disagreed. He felt that brain surgery might be harder. But I feel that, you know, when you're doing stand-up comedy, your life's on the line.
You're doing virtual brain surgery.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you're standing out on a stage in front of strangers and trying to make them laugh with thoughts that you think are funny.
It's a highly sensory feeling. I think Steve Martin described it best in his book, and he said, stand-up comedy is your lips moving and your mind racing ahead.
Yeah, that's very funny.
But
and
where they have
true.
It. And we have some other radio shows in the chat room listening to you now. I got a Betty Joe from Movie Attic Headquarters. Hey, Betty Joe, Tucker, if you ever do an episode on comedy and films, this would be the man to go to, Betty Joe. And George Bettinger from the Mom and Pop Shop. George Bettinger's show is every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. It's the Mom and Pop Shop. Go to Facebook and you can find it. It's at 106hotmix.com. And Betty Joe Tucker is Movie Attic Headquarters every Tuesday at 4 p.m. And there's some anonymous guest in the chat room, too, Jeffrey. I don't know if you have the chat room open, but
no, I don't know how to do that.
All right, just
that.
So you know, I have a chat room as well. So
okay.
There are two other radio shows listening to us right now.
Oh, cool. That's so nice that you get other industry people
checking
in. Oh,
actually,
in.
Betty
very...
Jo says you might have another interview coming up. Betty Jo says that is a good idea.
Awesome.
She does the film. She covers the film. She's got film blogs. She's got books out. But she does a lot of celebrities. You would be a good one to come for a comedy and films, okay? And George Bettinger as
mm-hmm.
well. I don't know. Do you know George Bettinger? Did you ever meet him, Jeff? In your
the
travel?
Name is so familiar. I have a feeling that I do know him, yeah.
I think you know him, and I'll tell you how you know George Bettinger, as a celebrity impersonator. He would do George Burns. He would do he's the voice of the red M&M. I'm trying to describe
Oh, really?
It,
now, there's something for your resume.
Right? Don't eat daddy.
The voice of the red M&M, not to be confused with the green or blue.
So let's talk about this book, Make 'em Laugh, 35 Years of the Comic Strip, the greatest comedy club of all time. Jeffrey Gurian and Richie Tenken, with an introduction by Chris Rock, very impressive. So what made you decide you wanted to, with everything else you're doing, Jeffrey, spiritual healing.
Yeah, I have a lot of hyphens.
World.
A lot of hyphens in my name, yeah.
Yeah, what made you decide that you wanted to write a book about the comic strip?
I was at the club in 2008, one afternoon with Ann Curry and Gilbert Gottfried, and we were coaching Ann on how to do stand-up comedy for some event that she was doing, and was really very funny. She's just great, a wonderful person, and I was just struck. I had been in the strip for so many years, but I was looking at the walls, and I'm standing there with Richie, and I was so impressed by all the huge stars that came out of this club and called it their home. You know, they performed in many clubs, but they referred to the comic strip as their home. And, you know, it opened on June 1st of 1976, and on June 17th, Jerry Seinfeld walked into audition, and his sign-up sheet is still on the wall. In those days, when you came in, you had to fill out a sheet with your name and phone number and address, and they graded you. And so his grade was good. They said he was good, and they wrote on it, definitely invite back Monday 6/21. And we have that on the wall, and it's part of the book. You know, it's like comedy history, you know.
Oh,
amazing.
It's great. And the comic strip, too. Part I liked, and believe me, I do read every book I have on my show.
Uh-huh.
I liked how the bar started. I mean, well, if you could give us a little backstory.
Sure.
On how they started this. Go ahead.
Just to finish what I was saying, so I'm looking at all the pictures there, and I said to Richie, we got to do a book on this club. And it seems that I wasn't aware of it, that other people had presented that idea to him, and he never went along with it for whatever reason. But the idea struck him, and he came to my house for me to talk about it. And he saw that I had more pictures on my walls than he had at the club. And he said, I think maybe you're the guy to do this. And, you know, we started it that year. I got the first three interviews. And then it took 3 years to get all of the interviews that you see in the book. Because it's, you know, Jerry Seinfeld and Chris Rock, of course, who really stepped up and wrote an amazingly funny introduction, like a 5-page introduction. Because he was discovered in the club in 1986 by Eddie Murphy when Richie was managing Eddie. And Eddie was the biggest star in the world at the time.
That was very interesting about Eddie Murphy in your book.
Yeah, and I'll go into that.
A lot I didn't know. I was like, whoa.
That's what I tried to do. I tried to go for stories that most people had never heard before. You know, Ray Romano, Paul Reiser, Susie Essman, Colin Quinn, they all came into the club. You know, Jackie Martling, who you played before, gave, I think, the longest interview on record. He went on for 2 hours. 2 hours and only stopped because I think my tape ran out, you know. He had a million stories, you know, his jokes go on and on.
I love, you know, if you ever get a chance to see his one-man show, it's terrific. And it's not him just doing jokes, it's him telling the story of his life, and they're great stories, but he is a good storyteller.
Oh, he is. Well, he's one of the few. Who does that? You know, he's the first one to say, I'm not a stand-up, I'm a joke teller. You know, in the tradition of Myron Cohn, maybe, who only did clean jokes, and I don't think Jackie ever heard a clean joke, but if he did, he made a point of not remembering it.
Well, I played the two clean ones I could find.
Yeah, that was it. I think that's why you had to stop after that. But he's hysterical, you know, they all came in. Jeffrey Ross came in, and Larry Miller, and on and on.
And let's talk about the neighborhood. Let's go backtrack a little bit
about
the neighborhood.
Well, what happened was I interviewed Rick Newman for the book, which was a real treat. Rick,
I love Rick, yeah.
Had opened Catch a Rising Star at the end of 1972. Before that, Bud Friedman had opened the Improv in 1963. And that was really the only club that was around, a major club. And it didn't start as a comedy club. They used to have singers there, musicians, and comedy mixed in. You know, and everybody wanted to be at the Improv. You know, it was Robert Klein and David Brenner and stars of that ilk.
Lily Tomlin.
Sure. All the big stars of those days. But there weren't a lot of people doing comedy. It's not like today where there's like hundreds of thousands of comedians. Everybody
like
you meet
ants.
Is a stand-up comedian. Yeah, I mean, it's really fascinating how many people are doing stand-up these days. But in those days, it wasn't the case. And so when Rick opened Catch at the end of 1972, it was on 77th and 1st. And it was funny because a few years later, I moved into 76th and 1st. I lived right down the block. And Paul Reiser lived right across the street from me on 76th also.
Now it's a Chinese restaurant, I think.
Yeah, I think it is. But it's franchised around the country.
Although I was telling people that about Catch, that Rick Newman's name is still affiliated, because it's Rick Newman's Catch a Rising Star?
Yes,
or?
He did that on purpose, mm-hmm. So that if it didn't work out, people would still remember his name. That's
and
part of the
yes,
interview.
I've headlined at the one in Princeton.
And he just opened something new on 72nd Street. He opened up, he refurbished the Triad Theater, he and his partners. It's supposed
to
be
lovely,
fantastic.
Theater.
Yeah, and it's going to be all kinds of entertainment, mostly comedy, but a theater that's going to promote all kinds of entertainment, music and film and
I've seen a lot of great
everything.
Shows. It's a fantastic space. And Richie was had a bar in the Bronx?
Yeah, he owned 6 bars in the Bronx. That was his thing. He was a bar owner. He had a partner, and they had a bartender named Tony DeAndrea, and Tony did impressions. That was his thing, right? And he was very excited. He got an audition at Catch a Rising Star. And he asked Richie to come down and see him. It was a Monday night. And Richie said Monday nights in the Bronx were dead. There was like three people in the whole bar. So he felt it was safe to leave the bar and come down to see Tony. So they went down to Catch, and he brought 14 people with him. And it was a drinking crowd. And they were drinking and drinking and drinking, and they were getting drunk, and Tony wasn't going on stage. But the place was packed, right? And so he was shocked that on a Monday night that he would find a place that was so packed. So finally he said to Tony, you better go ask Rick when you're going up, because we're getting drunk here, you know? And so he went to ask Rick. And Rick, he said, Rick made some kind of comment, like, you know, because he said, I brought 14 people, when am I going up? And Rick said something like, customers I don't need, you'll go up when I tell you to go up. And Richie was shocked. He never heard of a guy, you know, saying customers I don't need, because he was, like, starving for customers on a Monday. So he started coming down every night, and he started to watch the phenomenon that there were lines around the block, and the bar was, like, four deep, you know. And he started thinking to himself, there must be room for another club here, because not everybody can even get in to Catch. They were so busy that they had to turn people away.
I remember, yeah.
So he talked to his partner. He said, we should really look for a space. And they needed somebody in the entertainment business to help them. And they found this guy, Bob Wax, who was an attorney at the time. And the first time they were on their way to meet Bob, Richie said he and his other partner were in a taxi going down Second Avenue. And the partner says to him, this is all fine, but where are we going to find a place like this? And Richie says he looked out the window and he sees the Shannon Bar and it's closed. And he goes right over there and he tells the cab to pull over. They get out of the cab. They look at this place. It's closed. They go around the corner. They get the landlord. He opens up the place for them and they think it's ideal. And the landlord also, but it wasn't big enough. So they went, there was a backyard, and they said, who owns the backyard? And the landlord said, it's ours. He said, well, we want this too. And so he also owned the building next door. They took that backyard too, which is why the comic strip has that, like, kind of an L shape to it.
Yes.
And they made a deal, and they went on to meet their other partner, Bob. And Bob said, well, okay, this is great, but where are we going to find a place like this? And Richie's like, we just found it. It's the Shannon Bar on 81st and 2nd, right? So now they have the place, and it almost didn't open because just before they were ready to start construction on it, the contractor took all of Richie's money and disappeared. And in those, it was like 15 grand or something like that, and it was gone. And Richie had no more money to build the place, and he was like in a panic. So he was going to go to the landlord, who was also in the book, David Eberhard. I interviewed him because he played a major role. If it wasn't for him, this club wouldn't exist. Richie went to him, and he told him his money's gone, and he wanted to get out of the lease. And Eberhard said, let me come and look at the space. So he went over with him, and he said, what do you need to do? Richie told him what he wanted to do. He goes, here's a phone number. Call this phone number. Tell them that I said to send over, like, plumbers and electricians and whoever you need, because he said he was also an architect and a builder, and he wound up building the place for Richie. Isn't that cool?
That is so amazing. And that became the comic strip, which has been the home to many a famous – I'll be walking by there, and I'll go, was that Ray Romano that just passed me? You know?
Yeah, exactly. It's unbelievable, and they still come by. Chappelle was in the other night, you know.
And this is all part of what Jeffrey, if you've just, there are people, you can't see it, I have a chat room as well, but there are people popping in and out of the chat room listening. We're here with Jeffrey Gurian, who just wrote, Make 'em Laugh, oh, 35 years of the comic strip, the greatest comedy club of all time. And anyway, you have a listener, Cyanide in Amsterdam. Go get this book. I know you like comedy because you're always listening to my show.
In Amsterdam, the country of Amsterdam?
Oh, yeah. People listen to this show from all over the world.
How
cool is
that?
You've got somebody in Colorado.
Wow.
You've got somebody in Florida. And Alan S. Alan S., are you the guy that taped the Women in Laughter? I think that's who that is.
And can they actually speak, or do they type in stuff? I am?
People can call in if they want, but these people are, they type in and make comments about it. That's very good, Jeff, kind of thing. So
wow.
In the room. Yes, that's Alan from Ladies of Laughter.
That is so cool that you have such a
far
reach.
You know Alan from Ladies of Laughter?
I believe I do.
Yes, he's in the chat room too.
Oh, cool.
And Betty Jo Tucker, who does Movie Attic Headquarters, and I got to do a mention for her. She's going to have next Tuesday at 4 p.m. M. Night, I can never say this guy's name, Betty Jo, Shyamalan tribute.
Yeah, that's a wild name. There's a Y in there someplace. That's what's confusing about it.
Shyamalan.
I know.
And they're going to discuss suspenseful movies next Tuesday at 4 p.m. And I'm going to play a little bit of George for you right now, just so you can take a sip of water, because I've had you talking so long. Here's my little promo from George Bettinger from the Mom and Pop Shop.
Say to see good writing, the deck will come down and pay you $1,000. You're listening to Nancy Lombardo on Comedy Concepts. Hey, Mo! When is it, Carly? What is it? I want to listen to Nancy Lombardo on Comedy Concepts. Ruff. You know, it's an amazing thing. This is Jackie Mason, and you're listening to Comedy Concepts with my good friend Nancy Lombardo right here on the wonderful station on Blog Talk Radio. If you knew it, if you only knew what you were hearing, you'd understand that this is the greatest program a person could ever have. Nancy Lombardo right here at Comedy Concepts.
That's George Bettinger, just so you know, Jeffrey.
I really thought it was Jackie, I swear.
He is. Well, that's what George does. So he's got a retro kind of comedy show, The Mom and Pop Shop. You can go to his Facebook page and see it. I'll send you his info.
George, I love impressionists.
He interviews, he loves comedians.
Uh-huh.
So he does interviews pre-taped. So you must talk with him.
I would love to talk with him. We did something funny recently. Jay Farrow from Saturday Night Live does a lot of voices. You know, he's great. And he took the book and he read Chris Rock's introduction in Chris Rock's voice. And I had my camera guy there, and we filmed it. And it's on my Comedy Matters TV channel. It's hysterical. He was doing it for J.B. Smoove and myself and a bunch of comedy executives.
He is great.
They were hanging out in the lobby of the Hyatt Hotel during the Just for Laughs Festival. And just on a whim, Jay just took the book. Well, because he's in it, too. There's a chapter called The Next Generation of Stars That Are Coming Up. And so I wrote about Jay Farrow because he's a regular at the Strip, and he's so talented.
He is, and, you know, I'm not a star on Saturday Night Live, but I'm a background player for a lot of the sketches.
Uh-huh.
So I work up close with these people, and the whole cast is so nice.
Yeah, they're so great. And Colin Jost is in there, too. He's the new head writer on the show.
Well, you've got a lot of people. Let's just go down some of the people you have here because I've got it right in front of me. You've got... I put them into categories first.
I did it as if it was a family. The parents of the club, and then the older kids, and the younger kids, and then friends of the family, and then the next generation.
And Larry Miller is just hilarious.
He is unbelievable.
Did you see him at the Tom Cruise event?
I wasn't at the Tom Cruise event.
The Friars had the Tom Cruise event?
Yeah, I had something to do that night. But Paul was so funny. You know, in the early days, he didn't have an 8x10 for the club. So he used a picture of him and his family at a Passover Seder. And that was that picture is still on the wall. And that was his headshot until he got pictures taken of him at a Seder. And what was so cool, if you look close, you could see that under his suit jacket, he's wearing his comic strip T-shirt because they were so proud of them in those days. Jerry Seinfeld used to wear his on stage all the time. And, you know,
very funny in your book. I remember that section. You said that all the comics really didn't have to do laundry because all they needed was a shirt, the comic strip T-shirt, and a pair of jeans.
Right, and they fed them, so they didn't need food. They were so happy.
Oh, those were the days, Jeff.
Right, with whatever money they made. Larry Miller said, I think he said he was making $80 a week, and he felt like a king. People were borrowing money from him all the time because he would save his money. He was one of the few people who did, you know. Seinfeld was, I think he became... the MC, the fastest of anyone. Within 3 months of performing there, he became the MC. And then he started MCing on one night, and then they bumped him up to 3 nights a week. And when he got that, he said he was making enough money, which was probably about $75 to $80 a week, that he could quit some silly job he had as a waiter in a restaurant someplace. It was the only non-show business job he ever had, and it went on for about 3 months, and that was it.
He is, again, not only a good actor, he's a phenomenal storyteller.
Jerry? Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He tells, it's great. It's terrific. But those are, like, that's some of the other ones. But you have, like, Paul Reiser. Wonderful.
Paul Reiser told me a great, you know, in the middle of our interview, he remembered how their famous New Year's brunch started. They've been doing, you know, for over 30 years, every New Year's Day, no matter where they are in the world, he and Jerry Seinfeld and Mark Schiff and Larry Miller get together. And there was a fifth in that group, a guy named Michael Caine, who passed away very young.
Yeah, I remember the name.
He was one of their original group.
Schiff? Mike Schiff or Mark Schiff?
Mark Schiff.
Mark Schiff, okay.
Yeah, Michael Caine and Mark Schiff. And they have brunch at the Brooklyn Diner, I think it was, a place in Brooklyn, and then afterwards they walk over the Brooklyn Bridge. And no one remembered how it started. And in the middle of Paul's interview, he goes, you know what, I remember how it started. When he got to the comic strip, he was dating Kara Leifer.
That's right.
And he said the next thing he knew, Jerry Seinfeld was dating Kara Leifer, and he never knew how that happened. And so he goes, he didn't really know Jerry. There was a little bit of awkwardness there. And he said, so before New Year's of 1980, the night before, he went over to Jerry, and he put out his hand to shake his hand, and he goes, let's put this Carol thing behind us, okay? And they shook hands. He goes, because we should be friends. And they became best friends after that, and the next day was when they started the brunch. And Paul said if he hadn't done that, if they hadn't shook hands that night, that would have never happened, because there was that strangeness between them, that unspoken thing that was going on.
Guys.
Isn't that cool?
Guys. It's so typical, too. Because
yeah, well, I guess it was a strange scenario. Richie said everybody knew but Paul.
And Carol Leifer on her own was very funny. I think the funniest line that I ever heard her say was someone was at her house and she had been married before. And when people ask her what the wedding album is, she goes, oh, that was a play I was in.
Well, you know, in those days there weren't many women comics. There were
not a lot.
You know, Elaine Boozler, I think, was around. She actually gave me a blurb for the back of my book. You know, she was the first woman to have a cable TV special.
Elaine Boozler is phenomenal. I don't know about you, Jeffrey, but my gauge of what is a good comic, and because I do the clubs or whatever, I see a lot of them. You're like, oh, but
yeah, right.
Gauge, if I can remember any part of your act, you're a great comic.
Yes, exactly. If something stands out, yeah.
If I'm telling somebody, I heard this great guy said this great thing, and Elaine Boozler's up there with one of them, Susie Essman, I love. Lisa Lampanelli, tell us about Lisa and Fellow Friar.
Lisa was fantastic. You know, she started out as a rock journalist, and she said she wasn't a groupie because in those days she was too heavy and people didn't want to have sex with her. So she wasn't a groupie, but she wrote about all the bands, you know, and then she just got tired of being a journalist because she realized that she was funny and she wanted to go out on stage. And she's amazing. I just went to see a preview for her new play. She's working on a Broadway show. You know,
oh, yeah, I saw an excerpt, I believe, on, of all things, The Doctors.
Really? Well, yeah, she was on Dr. Oz recently. I don't know if that's what you're referring
to. Well, it was one of those, but she was doing an excerpt. Is it the part about her going to have the stomach surgery and the...
That was part of it. She talks about that. She lost 100 pounds. She looks phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. And I'm so proud of her for everything that she's accomplishing. I mean, her career just blew up a while ago, but, I mean, it just gets bigger and bigger all the time. And I remember being with her in Montreal one night when things weren't going the way she wanted them to, and she was concerned about it, whether people were getting her spirit. Because, you know, she comes from a place of love. You know, she makes fun of everybody in the world. But she's so cool. She's a very nice lady. Yeah, and she's coming from a really good place. And if the audience doesn't get that, they misunderstand her material. And this was the early days. And so...
Well, that you know, it's interesting, too, that when men talk that way, it's not really a big deal.
That's true.
Because I've heard worse than things she said. I've had things like I'm gasping backwards.
And there's a lot of ugly comedy today too, which I don't know what the fascination is with the bathroom humor, and I don't like to say. I mean, look, I wrote Friar's Roast for many years, so I know about filth and stuff, and that doesn't bother me. But there are certain topics.
No, but it's funny.
It's funny,
wording,
like sexual humor is
but
fine.
The humor I hear is basically misogynistic and
they're fascinated by going to the bathroom, like kids in elementary school. I don't get it. I don't understand.
Oh my God, Jeffrey, I can't tell you some of the things I have seen because this is a clean show.
Yeah.
But I go, oh no, he didn't just do that on stage.
Right, and me too. And I'm like, I don't want to be sitting there with a date and listening to ugly stuff like that. And I, you know, like. A lot of that, like, I went out to Brooklyn recently. I guess I experienced hipster comedy. And almost every person that came up was talking about stuff like that. I'm like, what's that about, you know?
Yeah, and, Betty Jo Tucker says, and vomiting.
Yeah, exactly. Like things that, like, you know, seven-year-olds find funny. And everyone has a beard, even the women. It's like everyone has a beard and looks like they're from like a. They live in a small cabin in the woods somewhere. They look like the Unabomber.
Yeah, I think you and I are from the same school of comedy. In that, I do believe that when you're a comedian, you have a responsibility to appear clean.
Well, look, you could do
well
both,
dressed.
You know. Clean that way. Yeah.
That you have a physical responsibility
to
appear like you actually care about the people you're performing for.
Well, you know, for a long time it kept me from performing because I didn't have old enough clothing. You know, I noticed that you have to look basically homeless to go on stage. And people are wearing, like, stretched out. Some guy came up to audition the other night with a sweater that looked like it was made for a group of people. Instead of just him, and somewhat Rich Voss, I think, commented like it was great that you could at least find a sweater that fit you, because the sleeves were hanging down to the floor, the body was all stretched out, and you know, I think people think that you can't have any kind of an appearance.
No, but I think it's like Lily Tomlin, who was always very class when she showed up, but it was like I just see like the women. Dress down, and I'm thinking, but you're a woman, it's okay. You dress like a woman.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like, I don't know, there's this theory, I guess, that people don't, well, you know, I understand it to a degree. I've changed, like, I go to a lot of events during the week, and if I have to perform on a night when I'm going to an event, I'll dress one way for the event than I will to go on stage, because if I wear the clothes that I usually wear to go out, and some of my clothes are very out there, you know, kind of like, I don't want to say loud, but I wear a lot of colors and stuff. I wouldn't wear that to do comedy because it's distracting.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I wear Purell hanging from my belt, you know, a little bottle of Purell because I shake so many hands. And if I forget to take that off on stage, people are staring at that, wondering what it is, and then they're not concentrating on what I'm saying. And so I do understand that you don't want to be too outrageous.
Oh, yeah,
in your
you
look.
Don't want to be too outrageous unless that is your character persona.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Like Phyllis Diller.
Yes, exactly.
Unless it's the persona comedy.
Right, if it's for your persona, then you can pull it off.
But it's just like you're like, please, that's the T-shirt's dirty.
Yeah, exactly. Put on something, a jacket, something.
A jacket, like, or at least something flattering. You know,
I know.
It's
that's my feel. Well, you know, I came up in a time when a lot of performers would wear a suit on stage. They would wear, you know, I'm used to seeing black tie performances, you know. When I was a kid and I was first starting to write, I would go up to the Catskills a lot. And the performers always dressed well in the hotels. You couldn't go on stage in old clothes and ripped jeans. They would boo you off. In those days, they had these little knockers that they would hit. Like if you performed at the Concorde, or the Neverly Hotel, they gave the audience these little sticks with a wooden ball on the end, and you'd wrap them on the table, like instead of like applause,
oh,
you know.
God.
But if they didn't like something, they would like boo you off the stage. George Wallace told a great story that in his early days, he didn't have much experience. You know, he was selling bus advertising. When the club first opened, he was in the advertising business in 1976. And just before the construction was done, he came by and he sold them advertising so that every bus on 1st and 2nd Avenue had a sign on the back, "Eat, Drink, and Laugh at the Comic Strip." And that was his gig. And he was Jerry Seinfeld's roommate for many years. They became best friends and still are to this day. So he said to Richie, after he sold him the advertising, he's like, you know, I do a little stand-up comedy. And Richie said, well, go up and let me see what you could do. The club wasn't even finished yet. And he took a phone book and he turned it into a Bible and he became the Reverend George Wallace. And that's how it started. He said, "You're very funny." And he kept, you know, he would come up. But shortly after he started performing, somebody booked him at one of the Jewish hotels in the Catskills. And the crowds were very demanding because they were used to seeing the biggest stars, you know, Milton Berle and Eddie Cantor before them. And, you know, the all-time greats would all come up to the Catskills. And now here's George Wallace, this young black kid, and he went up, he said, for 45 minutes, he doesn't think he got one laugh. And he said it was 1,000 people, because that's the size of the audience in those days, and he didn't get one laugh, and he wanted to kill himself. He didn't even want to tell Jerry Seinfeld on the way home. And he went back to the comic strip the next night, and thank God he got a lot of laughs again. And he realized he was performing to the wrong crowd. He had no business being in the Catskills with like 5 months experience or something like that, you know, to face a crowd like that. 2 years later, he went back after he had been out in L.A. and he was a star already. And he went back and he killed at the same hotel. And one of the old waitresses who was still there said, "Hey, it's a lot better this time, right?" And he realized that he had done so bad that she remembered how bad he did, from 2 years before. From 2 years before.
I think as a comedian, when you get booked on something and you walk into a room and you go, "Oh, what were they thinking? This is not my crowd."
Yeah, exactly.
And you're like, "Oh my God."
A horrible feeling. Yeah, George.
I know. I go, "Oh no, old Irish, not my crowd."
Exactly, isn't that? Yeah, and then what do? It's too late. You got to do your best.
You just keep going.
You just keep going. Like, thank you for obeying the no laughing sign. That's
boom.
All you could do.
I just start doing one liners, going boom. I keep going.
That's all you can do. But when you're fresh, you know, out of the box, like he was. It was a devastating experience. It happened to Ray Romano, stopped performing for 2 years. Do you know the story of how he started as Jackie Roberts?
No.
He started his career. He also went to the Improv, and in those days they had a lottery show. Not a lottery show. The lottery show is what they do at the comic strip now. They had a lottery to see who would go up on stage. You had to pick a number. And if they picked your number, you would go up to perform. So Ray wanted to double his chances, so he figured he'd bring a friend with him, and they'd both pick numbers. And if the friend got picked, Ray would go up, you know, to perform. But he couldn't find a guy to come with him, so he brought a girl named Katie McCarthy, who was a friend of his from his neighborhood. So, of course, the way the universe works, she got picked, and he had to go on stage. And he said to her, "Look, tell them an androgynous name if they pick you. I can't go on under Katie McCarthy." So she tells him her name is Jackie Roberts. He goes on stage as Jackie Roberts. And, of course, he passes the audition. So now he has to perform as Jackie Roberts for the next 3 months because he was afraid to tell Silver Friedman that he lied about his name. He thought they wouldn't let him perform, right? So he said in the beginning the audiences were very generous. They liked whatever he did because beginner's luck he attributed it to. And then he goes, one night he bombed, and then he got stage fright. And he stopped performing for 2 years, and he went back to selling futons. And he said he used to deliver – that his best friend owned a futon business, and that's what he did. He would deliver futons, and he delivered a futon to Larry David, of all people.
Oh, my God.
Who was not happy with the delivery,
of course.
True, and made him take it back. And after 2 years, he couldn't take not performing anymore. It was on his mind. And he came back, but he came back to the comic strip. He killed off Jackie Roberts, and he came back as Ray Romano, and that's what started his career.
And he actually, and also, that's the things you'll read in this book, a fascinating also trivia is that he actually did an episode about the Futon King.
That's right. He did an episode about that. He incorporated that into his show.
I read the whole book.
You certainly did. And the comic strip is where he met his longtime manager, who's still with him, Rory Rosegarten. From the Conversation Company. Rory saw him performing there. I think he was handling Brian Regan at the time, and Brian had just won some big comedy contest for like $10,000, and Ray was up for the same contest. Ray said he followed in Brian Regan's footsteps, kind of whatever Brian did a year or so later, Ray would do. So just before Ray went up to win the $10,000, Rory said that he would be his manager. And Ray said it was probably so he could participate in the $10,000.
Could be.
But he's been his manager ever since. All these years they've stuck together.
Al Alan S. just said Larry put his old futon by the curb.
Probably.
By the good. And Betty Jo from Movie Attic Headquarters says she understands stage fright. Oh, believe it or not, the time has flown, my friend.
Wow.
So let's tell people where they can get this book.
Okay, well, it's in all Barnes & Nobles, probably all over the country, but I know in every Barnes & Noble in New York, which I was thrilled to find out, you can get it on Amazon.com. You can get it on the Comic Strip website, which is www.comicstriplive.com. And on my own website, which is jeffreygurian.com, JeffreyGurian.com.
And if they want to see some fun interviews, they go to?
They go to youtube.com/Gurian News Network. You'll see over 150 A-list celebrity interviews with everybody from Jimmy Fallon, Chelsea Handler, Jon Stewart, Chris Rock, just a lot of people, you know, and film stars as well, you know, Chaz Palminteri, Liv Tyler. I don't only limit myself to interviewing comedians.
No, if Jeffrey Gurian's not there, it's not an event.
Well, thank you, Nancy. It's
not
been
an
so
event
fun.
If you're not there. This book is terrific. I highly recommend it. Make them laugh. 35 years of the Comic Strip, the greatest comedy club of all time. And we didn't want to give away too much, but there are some interesting stories in here, the backstories on a lot of the comedians that you are really going to find interesting, and you must get this book. I want to say hi to Betty Jo Tucker, Movie Attic Headquarters, this Tuesday. Tribute to M. Shamalamalamalam tribute for the Sixth Sense and Signs, and that's at 4 p.m. every Tuesday, the George Bettinger Show, Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. at 106hotmix.com, and check them out and go to the Barnes & Noble and get your book, or go to Amazon and get it, or go to Jeff's website. And Jeff, I'm just looking here on your GNN network.
Yep.
You, there's some more videos that I didn't see yet. Bank with Chin, George Washington,
Well, those were some. Those were some animated films that I made that were in the Cannes Film Festival. Yeah, Man Robs Bank with His Chin, and College Professor Fired for Casually Removing His Spine.
Oh, well,
I've asked because
on my show.
You can't do that. You know, you can't remove body parts. And
oh, those are great. No, I got to go check out these other two and play them on my cable show.
Right, and Man with Infant's Head, sued by Wall Street firm. He claims he can't get a job on Wall Street because he has the head of a six-month-old infant. he suffers from infantilism, and they claim it has nothing to do with that. They claim that it's because he misrepresented his financial experience. They needed someone to run a multi-billion dollar hedge fund, and he ran the cash register in a bakery. So they didn't feel that he was qualified, but he says
that, don't give it all away. Let
I
him
won't.
Go there again. But I'm going to find them. I'm going to put them on my TV show.
Oh,
which,
good.
Oh, I got to plug my own TV show, which I always forget. Tonight it's the Nancy Lombardo Show at 7 p.m. on channels 83, 56, and 34 in New York City and worldwide on the internet, WMNN.org, the Nancy Lombardo Show, which I always forget. And, Jeff, this show will be archived and available for download for free on iTunes. Alan
Good.
S., thank you for joining the chat room. Cyanide,
nope.
Outside of Amsterdam, George Bettinger, Betty Jo Tucker, and we had drop-in guests with no names. Thank you, no-name people. Listen, go out and get this book. I highly recommend it. Make them laugh. 35 years of the Comic Strip, the greatest comedy club of all time. Go check out Jeffrey. Jeffrey, you have so many websites, I can't even say them. www.jeffreygurian.com. GurianNewsNetwork.com, and of course Facebook him and Twitter him so you can follow all the interesting things, because he'll post it. If you can't find him on the internet, Jeffrey Gurian, Facebook, find him there, and everybody
mm-hmm.
Facebook each other. Thank you for being a guest today, Jeff. You're
thanks
terrific.
So much. Thanks
can,
so much for having me.
For
the
hours.
Time flew. I know the time. I couldn't believe it. 45 minutes went by that quick. It's amazing.
Well,
so
thanks.
Fun.
Thank
Your
you
show
again,
is great.
Jeff, and best wishes. This is terrific.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on, Nancy.
Okay, bye.
Okay, bye-bye now.
That was Jeff Gurian. What a great guest. Boy, we could go on forever with him. Thank you for listening to Comedy Concepts on Blog Talk Radio.
I'll be enchanted.
Watch the Nancy Lombardo Show tonight at 7 p.m. live on
the by a white lobster that wore glitter and spoke with a French
thank
accent.
Thank you very much.
Now, what this meant, I'll never know. But I do know if I told anybody, I'd be labeled a lunatic. And labeling is wrong unless it's for the public good. Let's say you're at a party, and you can take out a labeling gun and start tagging people like they do in Wild Kingdom. Mars really nice? Except in an earthquake, you'd really be thinking he's old, he's slow. I can beat him to the Georgia. Oh yeah, LA's a jammed up situation. I'm in a false, I wouldn't purposely build my home over one. The one time I was naive enough to think that canary food was for the elderly. It made sense to me at the time, all those big black and white labels. And then a friend pointed out, Nancy, there's a difference between generic and geriatric. Boy, did I feel foolish not to be confused with that. But I do think they have a lot to do with each other, since men tend to do a lot of thinking from that area. What all this has to do with nothing is, don't you know? How my brain works and connects things, like so. So anytime you think I'm crazy, you're probably right.